parse and untangle such moments of pleasant emotional cacophony. To begin simply, one is seldom more prone to be overtaken by surprise than in that particular moment. Ordinarily, when I'm surprised, I react. But at that particular moment, I was, as the clichés of lurid prose would have it, spent. And so I did not shrink from the unexpected touch, but surrendered to it and accepted it. And of course, the unexpectedness was heightened by my virtual certainty that the two of us I had been most aware of were utterly and completely, indeed intimately, alone. Moreover, however disorienting our exertions might have been, I remained fully confident that I knew where both of our mouths were at the moment. It was anatomically impossible for either one of us to have a tongue touching me where I was being touched. And yes, that was also part of the surprise. I'm a fairly straightforward sort of guy, in spite of going to clubs with Gary Marvin occasionally. But I read a lot, so I know that there are many people who find the foot highly erotic. I myself have been known to take visual pleasure in a high arching instep, but more serious contact, like the readily identifiable licking of my instep that I was currently experiencing, was simply something that had never played across my erotic radar before. At which point, all this pleasurable surprise begins swirling in most confusing ways, because that clear identification, my instep is being licked by a tongue belonging to an unaccounted for other, carries with it an almost immediate inferential recognition, with the status of near certainty, that simultaneously dislodges the original surprise of unexpected is unknown and replaces it with the even more surprising unexpected is now known as identified but previously unaccounted for other. I was being licked by Saskia, and Saskia was non-human. This was new for me and both surprising and part of my experience of pleasure. And, remembering that all this is tumbling through my mind chaotically and something approaching this sequential arrangement without such linear clarity, there was one more thing that undeniably added both to the surprise and the pleasure. Saskia. Uh-oh.
Oh, no. Just click later, Richard. Restart later.
Saskia was a wolf. I wanted to start here for several reasons, the most obvious of which is that Erica told me that the theme of this conference was wild, and the wildest way that I could imagine introducing an audience to what I have to say on the topic would be to tell them about the time I had sex with a threesome involving a wolf. If I were titling parts of my paper, this introductory segment would be entitled Horizontal Dances with Wolves. And the conclusion, which I'm going to put off to the end where it belongs, would be similarly entitled Menagerie à Trois. But there are other reasons for starting here as well, and if I do my job well, I hope to do justice to them in what follows. I want this paper to have something to do with pleasure, just as that anecdote does. And I want it to be true to the competing and complementary pleasures of that anecdote, involving confusion and chaos and simultaneity on the one hand, and clarification and recognition on the other. That anecdote turns around a moment of meaningful, intimate contact across species boundaries, and I want this paper to think about those boundaries and about such contact. I hope, at least in passing, somewhere in this paper, to at least nod to the nature of the contact and the degree to which it disrupts a particularly anthropocentric convention concerning the hierarchy of sensory apparatuses. There are moments in that anecdote that are insistently grounded in specifics and other moments that seek to embed those specifics in larger formulations. And this, too, will be, I hope, an important part of this paper. And nowhere in this anecdote is the play between the particular and the comprehensive more explicitly named than in my recognition that there was an added surprise and pleasure in the awareness that the contact between myself and Saskia was a contact between a human and a wolf. This paper will not be entirely about wolves, except insofar as it will ask us to consider the wolf as the avatar of the strong case for a belief in some kind of essential wildness, in which any discussion of wolves must be a discussion of wildness, and any discussion of wildness must say something about wolves. So let's start there with Saskia and some of what it means to be a wolf. The sum of what it means to be a wolf that interests me in the context of this paper has relatively little to do with animal science and a great deal more to do with human culture. That is, I'm especially interested in a particularly odd, contradictory sense of what wolf means to our culture. For our culture, no animal enjoys a closer totemic kinship with humans than the dog. If one opts for traditional domestication narratives of the man's best friend variety, then the acme of fidelity is rendered iconically by the image of that RCA Victor used for years with the tagline, "His master's voice." If one opts instead for the coevolution narrative in which humans and canines evolved in a symbiotic system that proved mutually advantageous, then few evolutionary adaptations are more profoundly resonant than the one by which dog parted company with wolf to become companion to man. And by either narrative account, we are presented with an oddly, perhaps even impossibly, triangulated arrangement of wolf, man, and dog. The most popular articulation of this arrangement is fundamentally contradictory, asserting simultaneously that dogs evolved from wolves and that the former are domesticated, while the latter remains wild. What interests me most here is the persistence of a strict essentialism underlying this configuration of canines. The idea that the wildness of the wolf and the domesticity of the dog are each to a degree essential to their animal identities. Just as the truism goes that you can take a boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy, similar common sense formulations hold that one can take the wolf out of the wild, but not the wild out of the wolf. Yet the very existence of dog, as domestically partnered with humans, should serve as a constant reminder that one can indeed take the wild out of the wolf, except that the moment one becomes aware of having done so, one becomes aware that one's wolf has become one's dog. My first surprising interaction with Saskia was born of precisely this kind of moment of awareness, but going in the other direction. I first met Saskia in what was her native environment, a townhouse. And my first response was, "What a big, beautiful dog." Species identity was quickly corrected, and the customary chit-chat about such distinctions exchanged, while my conversational partner distracted Saskia by leading her to the refrigerator and extracting for her delectation an extremely large bone. Quite happily, Saskia delicately accepted the bone, taking it to a far corner of the room to amuse herself underneath a table while the humans talked, which we then did for some time. Quite quickly, the happy noises of the canine-bone interaction receded into the background as white noise, easily tuned out. At some point, however, I detected a shift in the sound, and without losing my thread in the conversation, expanded my horizon of awareness to include that dyad. Saskia, even though I now knew she was a wolf, continued to operate in my conscious thinking according to her first habitat-derived definition. I knew this because my conscious thought processed new data in the form of, roughly, "Jesus, that dog is splintering and devouring that bone." I kept up my part in the conversation, but I still recall the confusion of category being sorted in the part of my mind that was attending to Saskia. She was a well-behaved, housebroken, canine companion to a human, dog. And she was huge and splintering, the biggest beef bone I had ever seen between her jaws and swallowing every fragment, wolf. As long as I sat on the sofa in the townhouse, carrying on rational, almost 18th century salon-style conversation, the dog identity, even though I knew it to be wrong, retained priority. This continued for several encounters when I would visit, although the performance with the bone was a one-off, just for new visitors kind of thing. But there were other very distinctive behaviors that registered with me as unlike any others I had engaged in previously. For instance, on that first visit, once she finished her bone and became tired of our conversation, and on each subsequent visit where the conversation of humans had lasted beyond her level of patience, she would interrupt the conversation silently and effectively. With a delicacy of movement that became familiar to me, she would walk to a spot between the two speakers, threading her way as needed between any obstacles like furniture, and position herself orthogonally to whatever sight line she was interrupting between participants in the conversation. Making eye contact with neither party, she would stand large and immobile, staring intently ahead, whether that meant looking out the window or staring at a wall directly in front of her. Nor was this the only instance whereby she deployed her considerable physical presence as a form of nonverbal interspecies communicative act. One way that she would signal her comfort with my presence, excessively talkative though she may have found it, was that she began curling up by my feet. This is a familiar action to all of us, even those like myself who do not really fall into the category of dog people. And it was one of those behaviors that went along with the well-behaved, housebroken, doggy identity as townhouse dweller. Except there was a difference. It registered with me, but not consciously, until the day that it did, and my awareness then changed everything. This was a large animal. Yet when she curled up by my feet, she did not touch them. Unless you have known a wolf, there is a good chance that you do not fully appreciate what I'm trying to convey about not touching. My moment of awareness came when I did something that I had done in each of the previous instances, but this time did it while registering that our actions together were constituting a pattern. She would curl that extraordinarily large, warm, mammalian body in the nose-to-tail arc of domestic companionship, whether canine or feline, though seldom human. Never mind, go on. Yet all the while not touch, while being so incredibly close that my foot and ankle could feel the heat coming off her body. And even as I carried on a conversation that she was not interrupting, but accepting, I would move my foot and ankle just enough to make contact. And when I did this, she would then lean back into my leg. The moment that I realized that this pattern was one that we had been repeating, I interrupted the conversation I had been in to marvel at what I had just realized about the difference between Saskia's wolf identity and how I had previously always been thinking of her as a dog. That is, in a variety of ways, she had been politely, even doggedly, insistent about maintaining a spatial separation between us. Once you are aware of it, as I became at that moment, you can be amazed at what remarkable control of personal space a wolf has. She would get absurdly close without touching, make it impossible to deny her rather impressive presence, yet defer to me to initiate contact. This has not been my experience with dogs. I have known dogs to whom I've had no formal introduction. Let me do that again. I repeat, I've known dogs to whom I've had no formal introduction whatsoever leap over all the social niceties and begin familiarities with vigorous crotch sniffings and lickings. And the moment that I interrupted the ongoing conversation to note something that had just fallen into place for me about a category difference between wolf and dog, and how it was that I would now always recognize Saskia as a wolf, differing in some fundamental way from a dog, in that moment everything changed, and Saskia forever after behaved differently to me. There is some sadness attached to that, as well as a deep, companionate pleasure. I do not for a moment believe that Saskia understood what I was saying or any English at all. But I do believe that I was saying something accurate about myself and a change in perception internal to me that I was in that moment and forever afterwards communicating to Saskia in ways that she could understand, perhaps even in ways that I was not terribly clear about, depending so much as I do on those understandings that I can translate into English with which Saskia did not bother. Wolves, I understand, are profoundly pack animals and not only comfortable with, but committed to hierarchy. All the spirit of my good, liberal, egalitarian, ideological being rebels at such formulations and wishes to express solidarity with the underwolf against the overlord oppressor. But my lived experience with Saskia suggests that there may be some truth to it. She would control her spatial relation to me, inviting me to initiate contact with her, but not initiating that contact herself. However I manifested to her that altered recognition and acceptance of her identity, she responded by forever after changing her relation to me. The very separation and detachment that had registered so powerfully with me disappeared in that moment to be replaced by a new pack configuration that allowed her to identify herself through deferral to me within a pack order, while at the same time enabling a much freer realm of the play that she found so important in her life. In that oddly transfiguring moment in our relationship, when I signaled my recognition of a distinctive difference between doggy distance and lupine aloofness, that act of recognition elicited a reconfiguration of our identities as no longer constructed by outsider or stranger status, but enabling a new assemblage within which new possibilities of play existed, and which play, when enacted, caused our companionship to appear less wolf and more dog. Part of what interests me when I reflect on that transformative moment of recognition that contributed to redefining the way in which Saskia and I interacted is the effective cost that I alluded to a moment ago, as there is some sadness attached to that, as well as a deep companionate pleasure. The rearrangement of our context of relating had much to do with how I figured in relation to Saskia's past pack consciousness, which in turn had much to do with how I manifested my awareness of Saskia. What I alluded to is the deep companionate pleasure had much to do with a mutual acceptance of some form of pack identity, and is familiar to any who have enjoyed relationships with companion animals. The sadness attached to that has at least something to do with how such affiliations are immediately domestic and domesticating. Something wolfish was lost. To this day, and Saskia has now been dead for a while, this remains for me one of the difficult, effective knots to untangle in my relationship with her. Much, I hope most, of what I value in that relationship has to do with her and how I came to know her as an individual and as a wolf. But some of that, I readily acknowledge, has also to do with some totemic function that wolf holds for humans, something like an identity that entails at its core a wildness that stands outside of and obliquely oppositional to human civilization. What Saskia would enact simply by standing between conversants manifests the interruption of sociability that we tend to project not as a performance of, but as the essence of, wolf. So part of the challenge in thinking through this is not to stop at the recognition that people living in social communities project onto those outside of these social communities a set of attributes that are coded not as performance but as essence, but to carry that one step further and recognize that one feels a longing to be accepted precisely by those whom we define as outside, and also that should that acceptance be forthcoming, there will be, as a consequence of it, a sadness directly correlated to that longing at the loss of what was outside. Part of what I'm trying to think through in this paper are connections more intuited than yet fully clear to me between my last book, Wild Enlightenment, and my current large research project, which keeps growing vaster and more complicated in ways that I never originally imagined. My first articulation of the connection between these two projects continues to serve a purpose, but it's also becoming inadequate. I'm currently researching, as Erica said, the origins of the thoroughbred racehorse, about which I will be happy to talk at great length, given an opportunity, but I'm not taking it here, in what I intended as an exploration of what it means to invent an animal. My too clever by half formulation of a connection between these projects was that, having written a Yahoo book, I now needed to write a Wynnum book. The challenge that Gulliver's fourth voyage presents to how we think of ourselves is a simultaneous confrontation with those who seem to share an anatomical similarity and from whom we wish to dissociate ourselves on intellectual and behavioral grounds, and also with those whose anatomical differences we seek to overlook and ignore in order to assert an intellectual or behavioral similarity. Certainly, one part of what animates a connection between these two projects is my historically specific grounding in sight of 18th century culture. Both of these projects are interested in explorations of notions of subjectivity in the individual that exist around the uneasy dyad of embodied animality and self-conscious intellectual sociability. And they are particularly interested in exploring how those notions emerged in the context of an emergence of modern Western democratic politics that was ushered in by the dissolution of monarchical authority in Europe. And another part of the connection between these two projects is my commitment to the notion that it is useful to think through this historical grounding in conversation with what benefits post-humanist theory might have to offer to our discussion, particularly concerning expanded conceptions of animality and ecology. In what follows, I want to gesture in some of those directions without, I hope, wandering too far from where I began, and actually focusing less on the main project about thoroughbreds, thinking instead about how we might begin reimagining some work in 18th century literature by foregrounding some issues that are raised by our considerations of animality. So to begin with an 18th century fable, but not Swift's fable of humans, yahoos, and Wynnums, while at the same time keeping in play that trusty triad of human, dog, and wolf, I want to turn briefly to John Gay's fable, The Shepherd's Dog and the Wolf. The tale is briefly told in sprightly fashion. A fierce wolf terrorizes a community, successfully launching predatory attacks that the shepherd and his dog are unable to prevent. Eventually, one day, quite by accident, the shepherd's dog, Lightfoot, stumbles on the lair of the wolf in the middle of the forest. He proposes a truce. "Let us a while the war suspend and reason as from friend to friend." "A truce," replies the wolf, "'tis done." The dog then counsels mercy, flattering the wolf that he is too strong to prey on the weak and defenseless, that it would be testimony to his courage to exercise mercy and spare the defenseless sheep. In response, the wolf pleads natural necessity, turning the onus back onto man and his servant dog in terms that place the dog's request to reason as from friend to friend under stress. "If mindful of the bleeding wheel, thy bosom burn with real zeal, hence, and thy tyrant lord beseech, to him repeat thy moving speech. A wolf eats sheep, but now and then 10,000 are devoured by men. An open foe may prove a curse, but a pretended friend is worse." Gay's fables are interesting documents. Written as they were for a small boy destined to grow up to be known as Butcher Billy after the Battle of Culloden, their frequent disavowal of cruelty and brutality seemed to have failed to take hold in their primary audience. Often, however, as in this instance, they present a straightforward moral doctrine, only to complicate it in intriguing ways. The fable plays on our pat cultural formations. Wolves are bloodthirsty predators, and dogs are loyal and faithful servants. The dog, as agent for the rational human, proposes civilized conversation as the proper remedy to resolve dispute, and then urges the virtue of mercy on behalf of the weak and defenseless. He could be speaking for Jürgen Habermas. Wolves are wild, dogs are civilized. But Gay's wolf offers a direct and candid response. The plea of necessity, "nature made me this way," is the least likely argument to persuade one to abandon an appeal for mercy. The wolf, however, does not stop there, but presses into new territory, like an early modern avatar of the slow food movement. Sorry. The predations of a wolf now and again are nothing compared to the systematic slaughter of man, the dog's tyrant lord. In the wolf's speech, we see the dog from a different perspective. No longer loyal and faithful, he is a hypocrite, willing to upbraid the wolf for a few scattered predations, while remaining not only silent about, but complicit in, the systematic slaughter of those innocents for whom he pretends to speak. Nor is he done there. If a dog is man's best friend, Gay's wolf is not about to allow him to get away with his fawning displays. "An open foe may prove a curse, but a pretended friend is worse." The appeal for mercy that was introduced by "let us reason as from friend to friend" is here revealed to be a transparent ruse seen through from the outset. The wolf has not been taken in by the offer of false friendship and seems quite willing to resume the state of war that this parley has only suspended. We like the wolf. We admire the wolf. The wolf is honest and true. The dog is the betrayer. Having long ago betrayed the wolf by entering into a compact to serve man, his tyrant lord, he now pretends a friendship no more sincere than his concern for the innocent sheep who he protects for human slaughter. Perhaps that weakest of all defenses, the plea of necessity, is not so weak after all. If the wolf had listened to the friendly reason of the dog, he would have betrayed himself. And if the wolf betrayed his nature, would he not become a dog? Time for theory. What I'm going to advocate today, and in this portion of the talk, suddenly the slides will cascade more and more rapidly. And I'm going to ask you to read the quotes as I run through the text in between them. What I'm going to advocate today is a genealogical practice intended to complement, not entirely replace, familiar literary historical arguments about, in Keith Thomas's phrase, man in the natural world. Where traditional humanism defined culture around the privileged category of the human, the era of the post-human coincides with an intellectual reorientation to a world in which we are responsive agents within nature-culture networks. The paradigm of dominion, in which the world was a resource at the disposal of the human, is giving way to a paradigm of responsive interaction and mutual interdependencies, and our critical practices need to reflect and respond to that altered orientation. I want to touch, in what's left, extremely lightly on two works of post-human theory that I find especially bracing and useful, and from which I wish to extract a half dozen touchstones that will prompt me to reconsider how I used to read 18th century verse about nature. The first of these is the daunting and immensely stimulating Meeting the Universe Halfway by Karen Barad, a postmodern, post-humanist, feminist, queer physicist who's doing remarkable work about rethinking ontology that derives from the work of Niels Bohr in the first third of the 20th century. The second is Jacob von Uxkull's foray into the world of animals and humans, recently translated after interest in von Uxkull, who did his work in the first third of the 20th century, was reignited by postmodern philosopher Giorgio Agamben's discussion of him in the open. So there's an odd pairing of the first third of the 20th century and the end of the 20th and early 21st century. Barad is a physicist, deeply influenced by Niels Bohr, and interested in what her subtitle articulates with admirable economy, quantum physics and the entanglement of matter and meaning. Her argument is both demanding and rewarding, as good arguments often are, and I cannot and will not attempt to do justice to it here. Instead, I'm going to briefly characterize her most important ontological claim and extract from her exposition of that claim five critical features of her argument. One of the key problems in modern physics revolves around Niels Bohr and his protege Werner Heisenberg and their competing accounts of quantum mechanics. The latter's account is fundamentally epistemological and has been the dominant one in popular literature. His uncertainty principle locates the problem in our understanding of the world. Bohr's complementarity account is ontological, locating indeterminacy in the particles themselves. Where Heisenberg said that we can know a particle's position but not its momentum, or we can know its momentum but not its position, his principle maintained that position and momentum were both intrinsic attributes of a particle, and our knowledge of them was uncertain. Bohr's complementarity claim is that particles do not have determinate values of position and momentum simultaneously. As Brad develops over the course of her book, recent experimental physics, and especially work since the 1990s, has been able to conduct in the lab some of the crucial thought experiments of Bohr and Heisenberg. This work has tended to confirm Bohr's account over Heisenberg's. Following Bohr, and carrying some of the implications of his ontological claims farther, Barad advocates what she terms agential realism as an account of the world more responsive to the ontological pressure of complementarity. I want to unpack five key features of Barad's agential realist account: the priority of relation before relata, the notion of entanglement and entangled agency, post-humanism as referring to that which comes after human exceptionalism, notions of apparatus and phenomena as performative, and how this all works to advocate a non-particularist and relational account of the world. The fundamental reorientation in the account of matter that she presents is that we need to reimagine the world simply by positing that relation precedes relata. Our traditional physics has long been predicated on the observations of interactions between discrete bodies whose separability from one another as subject and object is determined by a Cartesian cup. This revision reconceptualizes these phenomena as interactions in an ongoing process, with relata emerging from the process as sedimented out by the agential cuts that identify entities as separate. The topsy-turviness of that formulation takes some getting used to, but it can become an acquired taste. Importantly, this reversal of priority claims with relating, preceding the coming into being of the relata, is important in offering an account that makes sense of the problem of quantum entanglement that so captures the popular imagination with notions of quantum leaps through a time-space continuum. The richest sense of entanglement here, meaning far more than confused or complicated or enmeshed, is at work in what I take to be a fundamentally ecological understanding of post-human that means not just after the human or in some unspecified way skeptical about humanism, but rather a reorientation toward how we make meaningful knowledge claims about our participation in the world as entangled in it, not hypothetically detachable from it. In the laboratory in physics, traditional accounts of our knowledge of the world are predicated on a separation between observer and observed, mediated by a measuring apparatus. The reconceiving of the world and our participation in it, imagined by Bohr and extended by Barad, reconfigures phenomena as performative productions of these apparatuses rather than objectively measured by them. And I take this to be at the heart of what I thought was going on in a moment in Q&A between Tim Ingold and I think it was Carrie, is it Carrie? Who was asking him the question, and he was thinking, then we need to rethink of ourselves as in the system. And I think this is what Barad is trying to work through. The philosophical consequence of this reorientation and towards replacing the particularism of Newtonian physics with a more relational, almost holistic view of the world. What I find, this is a long one, good luck with it, what I find most exciting in this notion of world and Barad's philosophy of phenomena is how it resonates with Jakob von Uxkull's notion of Umwelt, as we covered recently in Giorgio Agamben's The Open, Man and Animal. What I take to be the fundamental insight of von Uxkull is the observation at once strange and yet immediately self-evident that we do not share a world with other creatures. Rather, other creatures who inhabit alongside us a shared environment participate in that environment, both perceiving and responding to it, via the mediation of sensory apparatuses so distinct from our own as to make their world and ours quite different. In the example that von Uxkull and Agamben foreground, von Uxkull's experiments on a tick demonstrate that the tick's behavior can be accurately mapped according to three sensory ranges: a sensitivity and responsiveness to a particular range of odors, temperatures, and textures, and that furthermore the organism operates in what would seem to us quite fantastic ways in the absence of appropriate stimuli within this range. Von Uxkull documents, for instance, an 18-year state of suspended animation from which the tick emerges when presented with an appropriate stimulation. In coining the term Umwelt, von Uxkull is careful. Where do I go? Careful to distinguish it from environment, Umgebung, though, as Agamben notes, the latter term is merely a special, that is, human case of the former. I like to think this through with the idea of going for a walk with a dog, whereas the dog and human going for a walk are not walking through the same world so much as they are walking through overlapping Umwelts. The dog's sensory apparatus is detecting smells and sounds with a directional sense and with an acuity that the human is not. The human is recognizing a spectrum of colors that's not there for the dog, so that while they're walking through the same place, they're actually working through worlds that overlap but are not precisely identical, that their participation in the world is mediated through their apparatuses. Here I find in Agamben's return to von Uxkull's Umwelt a model for more complex world making that shares much with the agential realism Barad has generated from Borean physics. Baradian entanglement is about the inextricable ontological mixtures of nature cultures. Von Uxkull's Umwelts reorganize our world in terms of overlapping Umwelts. The constituting role of the laboratory apparatus in Barad's formulation and the sensory apparatus in von Uxkull's Umwelts equally remind us of the degree to which the world exceeds our own participation in, through which we come to know it, and ourselves, experientially out of our ongoing interactions or intra-actions with and within it. Each of these concepts challenge our received traditions we inherit from modernity. But in doing so, they prompt us to revisit the early modern period, attuned to less hegemonic voices, in which we can hear non-modern formulations. And now a rapid race through a small portion of William Somerville's wonderful but never read poem, The Chase. I want to suggest that when we think in terms of umwelts and entanglements, a poem like Somerville's The Chase recommends itself as more interesting and perhaps more important than we've tended to realize. Indeed, I want to make the claim that the most valuable moments in the poem derive from a tension between the tacit knowledge practices he describes from his hunting experience and those more conventional doctrines that he asserts over the top of them. Somerville asserts rather conventional doctrines of dominion, human exceptionalism, animal mechanism, etc. Yet frequently, his descriptive practice, I hope you can read this, his descriptive practice conjures up, in opposition to those doctrines, a richer, more complexly figured world, one that is easier to reconcile with Brodian entanglement and Wanigskill's umwelts than with the doctrines that the poem asserts explicitly in its most didactic moments. I'm going to open up, go directly to a digression on scent near the end of the first book, which is introduced by a scene in which the predations of a fox have been discovered and the huntsman calls out his hounds and successfully seeks justice. Soon as the morn reveals his wrongs, with ghastly visage wan, the plundered owner stands, and from his lips a thousand thronging curses burst their way. He calls his stout allies, and a line his faithful hound he leads, then with a voice that utters loud his rage, attentive cheers. Soon the sagacious brute, his curling tail flourished in air, low bending plies around his busy nose, the steaming vapor snuffs inquisitive, nor leaves one turf untried. Till conscious of the recent stains, his heart beats quick, his snuffling nose, his active tail attest his joy. Then with deep opening mouth that makes the welkin tremble, he proclaims the audacious felon. Foot by foot he marks his winding way, while all the listening crowd applaud his reasonings. O'er the watery fords, dry sandy heaths, and stony barren hills, o'er beaten paths with men and beasts disdained, unerring, he pursues, till at the cot arrived, and seizing by his guilty throat the caitiff vial, redeems the captive prey, so exquisitely delicate his sense. The reasonings of this sagacious brute proceed unerring to the meeting out of justice as a direct consequence of his exquisitely delicate sense. The animal sagacity here is deliberately contrasted to the figure who so happily anticipates Squire Western with his thousand thronging curses that burst their way and utter loud his rage. Here the human is the passionate beast, the hound the rational animal. Should we then read Somerville as not only anti-Cartesian, but proto-Peta? Far from it. And the digression that follows is as complex as any trail traversed anywhere in the poem. Should some more curious sportsman here inquire whence this sagacity, this wonderful power of tracing, step by step, or man or brute, what guide invisible points out their way o'er the dank marsh, bleak hill, and sandy plain, the courteous muse shall the dark cause reveal. The blood that from the heart incessant rolls in many a crimson tide, then here and there in smaller rills disparted as it flows propelled, the cirrus particles evade through the open pores and with the ambient air entangling mix. As fuming vapors rise and hang upon the gently purling brook, there by the incumbent atmosphere compressed. The panting chase grows warmer as he flies and through the network of the skin perspires, leaves a long streaming trail behind, which by the cooler air condensed remains, unless by some rude storm dispersed or rarefied by the meridian sun's intenser heat. To every shrub the warm effluvia cling, hang on the grass, impregnate earth and skies, with nostrils opening wide, o'er hill or dale, the vigorous hounds pursue with every breath, inhale the grateful steam, quick pleasures sting their tingling nerves, while they their thanks repay, and in triumphant melody confess the titillating joy. Thus, on the air depend the hunter's hopes. There is, in short, a physiological explanation for the dog's sagacity, and Somerville will clarify later that beasts are not rational in the way humans can be, and his clarification will come close to Cartesian mechanism. I do not wish to confuse Somerville with Wanigskill simply because both concern themselves with different species having different sensory apparatuses, nor do I wish to assert that Somerville was Brodian simply because the word entangling appears in his poem. But that does make a good place to start a reading of this passage. It is, I think, important to recall that Barad's entanglements are, among other things, nature-culture entanglements, that the world is not a culturally constructed mobilization of a pre-existent physical entity, nor an arrangement of discrete entities bouncing off one another, but a collaborative performance within which practices of engagement render the world meaningful. Even at the level of physical entanglement, Barad wants to be careful to warn against a simple reading of entwined agency. This book is about entanglements. To be entangled is not simply to be intertwined with another as in the joining of separate entities, but to lack an independent, self-contained existence. That caveat is an important one, and all the more important than when we realize that it in fact quite well corresponds to Somerville's description of how the cirrus particles with ambient air entangling mix. For indeed, Somerville's philosophy here is actually rather strongly counter to a hegemonic empiricism like that illustrated by Boyle's air pump apparatus, and can actually be more readily reconciled in an early modern context with something like Margaret Cavendish's corpuscular materialism, in which the apparently stable boundaries of physical bodies are in fact interpenetrable. Or leapfrogging from an early modern context to a more contemporary one, we might note that Somerville's account of scent, derived experientially from his tacit knowledge practice of hunting, anticipates something a good deal like an explanation we might give today of a pheromone trail. The passage deserves, I think, a longer reading than I'm going to give it here, but let me point out that the explanation offered for the problem of scent quickly opens to a rich and full description of the world that is not only all-encompassing, but within which it is precisely the Baradian reformulation of the world as lacking independent, self-contained existence that is foregrounded in the service of an articulation of a mutual entangling of blood, particles, air, vapor, leaves, temperature, condensation, breath, moisture, nerves, affect, in which a single system includes not only hare and hound, but the very world through which they move, and which is, by the movement through it, mobilized into being. Uh-oh, I've lost track of how many clicks I've made. And I would further point out that this entangled world is articulated precisely in response to a question about Umwelts, in which the occult mystery, dark cause reveal of a non-human sensory apparatus, is translated into the idiom of a human Umwelt, with a particularly rich visual imagery invoked to illustrate the workings of this guide invisible, which I think is where that's supposed to go. We should be 8 minutes left to go, more or less. Menagerie à toi. I began this talk, I hope not too long ago, with reference, among other things, to pleasure. Maybe it's time to try to get back there as a way to conclude. Derrida, quite famously, in directing his attention to animal-human relations, spun his meditations from an encounter in his bathroom, in which he found himself naked before his cat.
Can you take the screen?
Thank you.
Sorry.
War is waged over the matter of pity. The animal looks at us, and we are naked before it. Thinking, perhaps, begins there. The thinking that began there focused on the important affect of pity and characterized that importance as an ongoing war, not entirely unreminiscent of that ongoing war between wolf and dog in Gay's fable. One must, I think, agree with Haraway when she writes of Derrida's encounter with his cat that whatever else the cat might have been doing, Derrida's full male frontal human nudity before another, which was of such interest in his philosophical tradition, was of no consequence to her. As important as the question of pity is, I believe Haraway is right in pressing us to move beyond it and the self-involved projections that it will always encourage to other equally challenging and complicated questions. The question of suffering led Derrida to the virtue of pity, and that is not a small thing. But how much more promise is in the question, can animals play or work? And even, can I learn to play with this cat? Can I, the philosopher, respond to an invitation or recognize one when it is offered? What if work and play, and not just pity, open up when the possibility of mutual response without names is taken seriously as an everyday practice available to philosophy and science? What if a usable word for this is joy? For Derrida, being looked at by his cat introduces the question of what it means to be addressed, and his response to that question puts him at odds with Immanuel Levinas, who identified the face with ethical relations and then went out of his way to question whether the animal has a face. In the name of a dog, Levinas had insisted on the specificity of his dog. But enough of allegories. The dog is a dog, literally a dog. Certainly, Derrida is responding to Levinas when he insists on asserting a complementary specificity. I must immediately make it clear the cat I am talking about is a real cat, truly, believe me, a little cat. So too must I now insist on the specificity of Saski, that specific wolf with which I began. The surprise, not unpleasant, of Saski's tongue came sometime late in our relationship, well after my recognition of her wolfishness had triggered a reconfiguration of our pack identity that allowed her to engage with me differently. For a time, however, there was that period during which, while I thought of her as a large dog, she kept initiating these spatial reconfigurations in which she would present herself impossibly close to contact while waiting for me to initiate the actual contact. The first and most disconcerting, yet in its own way oddly pleasurable, of these instances occurred after the first night in which humans had coupled intimately. If I began these remarks somewhat abruptly with an account of immediate post-coital experience, it makes a kind of sense, if anything can at this point, to conclude with a few more words in the Obad tradition. The Obad, I remind you, is one of those particularly pleasing verse forms in which the poet speaks from the position of the well-satisfied lover awakening to the morning after the wonderful night before. So in prose goes my account. In that uniquely pleasing moment when two people, now freshly intimate with one another, begin for the very first time together those very mundane activities with which each of them has until now, either separately or partnered with someone else, begun their daily routine, there is a pace and rhythm unlike that we know at any other time. When you live alone, the movements after bed and before coffee take on a ritual form that renders one nearly an automaton, performing set functions in a particular order. There's a kind of comic familiarity to them. When one lives partnered, the vagaries of scheduling and shared obligations frequently modulate, but never entirely destroy, this mechanical component of diurnal routine. This is the time of, at best, functional communication, often in a terse verbal shorthand. I say terse there, and I keep wanting to read it as tense, which probably says something about me. A terse verbal shorthand, sometimes with fervent activity, sometimes placidly, responsibility shared in familiar ways, parallel tracks leading to the common destination, the cup of coffee. But the first morning shared between the sheets and the coffee cup is different. We are in someone's home ground, and that person knows the kitchen, prepares the coffee. And we are both in good humor, or the entire event is best forgotten and not talked about, and genuinely like, in this moment, not only our partner, but ourselves. Clothing is optional and for the most part discouraged, and conversation is actually encouraged. Not perfunctory communicative efficiency, but the verbal continuation of intimacy. If you do not recall this particular performance, my suggestion is that couples tend to schedule refresher courses for Sunday mornings. This is how I remember that particular intimate morning ritual. A succession of showers, emerging from the second of which, towel dry but still naked, I emerged from a bathroom to confront, not like Derrida, my own cat, but around a corner, my partner from the night before, wearing only a shirt and preparing coffee and rolls, and interested in resuming conversation. Standing in the hall, not quite crossing the threshold into that quintessential domestic space of the kitchen, where activity was humming with all the practiced familiarity of the resident presence, I was aware of my own non-resident status, and equally aware of being brought into that space verbally through a resumption of conversation. And as I stood there, I was aware how much our continuing conversation helped me to feel comfortable in my own being, my status of both in and not in, the welcomed outsider being granted access to domestic arrangements, so that I began to feel myself grow comfortable not only in my location, but in my nakedness as well. For most of us, being naked with another is not an ordinary practice. There was, at first, a discomfort and a slight chill that prompted me to leave and dress. But this was discouraged, and quickly the chill left, and with it the discomfort. and I began to feel pleasant, standing there naked on the threshold of domesticity, in conversation with this newfound, welcoming, loving other. And then in a moment, when the rules of the conversation dictated that I was now listening, not speaking, I looked down. It was an innocent, unprovoked, innocuous glance. But she was looking up. And all she was wearing was a wolfish grin. And I've already told you how much control of physical space she had, so you can imagine how close she was and how vulnerable I felt. To be precise, I have never in my life felt more vulnerable, more exposed, more fully naked than in that moment. And even though we were in a townhouse making breakfast, conversing, I was not thinking dog. I was not really thinking at all, but my neural signals were screaming wolf. And yet I stood there unflinching and continued to obey the rules of the game that said listen, so that when my turn came, I could in fact speak. And as the conversation continued, I stood rooted to the ground by that mixture of terror and wonder that in aesthetics we term the sublime, intently aware of my own quite vulnerable feelings in this proximity to the oxymoronic captive bred wolf on the threshold of the kitchen in the townhouse. And the vulnerability came to feel more and more pleasurable. For whatever reason, the initial presentation in which Saskia invited but did not require my touch might have made me aware of her wolf identity in the present, but it did not carry over. Perhaps this is because, for reasons you can readily imagine, I studiously refused the invitation to contact on this particular occasion. We continued our interactions with the delicate preservation of some space separating us for some time until that encounter I narrated earlier, when I recognized her control of the spatial configuration as a defining sign of wolfishness. And my recognition triggered her acceptance of me into a pack in which she had already defined her own role. As I have said, after that, a threshold had been crossed for each of us, and our encounters, often playful and sometimes not, would enact our mutually accepted social organization as belonging to a network larger than ourselves. That was the pleasure of her tongue that I spoke of earlier. Not so much the thrill of erotic pleasure, nor even the thrill of some trespassing touch of the wild, though this is how it figured originally and to some degree still figures within the mental framework of our culture's usual narratives. It was instead that warm, companionate touch of an intimacy of inclusion. It was a reminder that even in those moments when we feel simultaneously each of us most alive in our own beings and also most paired with one another, even in those moments, we go on being part of a larger network, a greater web to which we belong. And the acceptance of this awareness, the crossing of that threshold, out of ourselves and into an impossibly larger pack perception of connected nodal identities, changes forever our perception of a clear threshold that separates domestic and wild. If there is anything essentially wild, it is not a wolf, and certainly not a third-generation captive-bred wolf like Saskia, but it may be the notion of a larger world in which we are already included and which awaits us when we recognize how patiently it is waiting to be noticed just beyond the threshold of ourselves. Thank you.